My name's Joan Olson, and I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, I've been sober since Veterans Day, November 11th, 1986. And thank you so much to the committee for asking me to come here. It's very, very beautiful. And Jerry and Jill picked me up at the airport, and that was a treat. We hadn't seen each other for quite a while. And I love them a lot. Oh, God, it's going to be a crying night. Oh, my. And it was funny because Mildred was on the same plane, and we didn't even know it. I was busy knocking over the stewardess with my backpack and apologizing, so I whisked by her and didn't even see her. So that was funny when I got off, and there she was, and we'd been on a little 10-row plane. I still hum a lot. I was born and raised in Decorah, Iowa, which is in the northeastern corner of the state, real close to the Minnesota border. So I'm used to a lot of snow. And I was born to a Norwegian-German family. So that tells you about willpower. I have it. I have a lot of it. And, you know, my childhood growing up was, you know, pretty normal. I mean, my dad's an alcoholic, but that's not why I drink. I drink because I drank, and I'm an alcoholic. And if you're here and you're blaming someone else, get off the trip, because you're going to kill yourself. Because the only one that can change you is you, you know. And I hope you find that gift if you don't have it yet. Pretty, you know, like I said, pretty normal childhood. Other than that, you know, I grew up in the real, you know how our households are. They're very, very quiet when you grow up, because you never know when dad's going to come home and what kind of mood he's going to be in. It's going to be good, or it's going to be very, very quiet. And I grew up in a real quiet household, and I escaped into books early on. That was my early escape. I was Drew. I love those. As eight college students are in. So, you know, what you do in high school is you get a girlfriend with a car, and you cruise a six-block strip, back and forth, honking at each other, woo, you know. Big Friday, Saturday night in Decorah. That's what you do. And that's what I did. And on one particular night, two of my girlfriends and I met a couple college boys from Winona State up in Winona, Minnesota. And they gave us their phone numbers and said, come on up and visit them sometime. So we did the next weekend. I don't think they expected us to do such a quick turnaround, but we did. And they took us to a bar. And you know, some people do and some people don't remember their first or last drink. I happen to remember both of mine very, very vividly. And my first drink was, and this is really goofy, because the drinking age in Minnesota is 19 and I was 18. And I just had to drive like 5 miles across the border to be in Wisconsin where it's 18. But oh no, that's not where the men were. This is the starting of a pattern that would continue throughout my drinking. My first drink was when I was 18 years old at the Mississippi Queen. And the boys ordered a 7-7, so I ordered a 7-7. And I took a drink, and it went down. And that's when the magic happened for me. After that first drink, I was no longer shy. I was no longer scared. I no longer cared what you thought. Just like that, boom, I became the wittiest, tittiest, B-I-T-C-H around. Bam! It was magic. And I can assure you that if it still worked for me like that, right here, right now, you'd be having a different speaker. Because I'd still be doing it. Because it was wonderful. But what happened for me is, you know, alcohol took me to the places where alcoholic women go. And I went to college in my hometown for a year and a half. And the heat started getting very hot because at Luther College, my mother hired all the student workers for food service, which is a very large organization in the college. And she was getting direct reports on a consistent basis on my activities. And my activities weren't good. I had joined the party sorority because they partied, and that's what I was doing. And so I had a year and a half, I decided after being there, I'm just like, I have to get out of here. decor is the problem. I've been here all my life. It's so small town. I need to move. And I had a friend who had moved to Ames, Iowa, which is in the middle of the state. I seem to have a tendency to move just a little bit south, just a little bit west, little south, little west. And Matt called and said, well, you know, why don't you come here, check it out, maybe you'll like it, get a job. He was a cook at Perkins. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like the thing to do. So I just told my folks I was going to go visit Matt for a weekend. And I drove there and applied at Happy Chef and got a job as a waitress and just moved there. And, you know, told them I was going to work for a year because then I could declare myself independent and get aid to go to Iowa State. And, you know, that's what I did. And the first year that I lived in Ames, I lived 8 different places. I lived with a couple, you know, cute little sorority gals, and then 3 cute fraternity boys, and then my best drinking girlfriend and a cop that worked the night shift. And I just, you know, it was wild because when you drink like I drink, you have to finance your drinking through bad checks and maxing out credit cards. And then you can't pay them, so you have to keep moving because they're after you. And you know they're looking for you, so you have to stay ahead of them. So I was very busy moving all the time. And in the meantime, it started working at the Golden Corral, which I know started down south, so you know what that is. And I met him. And he was a cook at the Golden Corral. And it was love. It was love. And, you know, we'd known each other about 3 months, and we decided to get married. And I've always been the kind of woman that needed a man there to validate myself. And I was afraid I was going to be alone forever, so I married him. And it didn't last long. There's a shock. I was drinking a lot, and then I started playing with drugs just to see if I could get there again. So you name it, I've done it, except for needles. I don't know how you guys do that. That's just, but everything else. And and he was a dealer. And where the problem started is he dealt, but he used more than he dealt. And apparently I've always been destined for a career in sales. So I'm like, that's stupid. You know, if you're going to sell this stuff, you need to have more money coming in. Hello, duh, it's an economic thing. And he didn't do that. So on our first year wedding anniversary, I kicked him out, as everything was in my name because I was paying the bills. So once I kicked him out and got going, my drinking really accelerated. And, you know, it takes a lot of willpower. You know, my mom for years, you know, God bless her, she's an Al-Anon, and she's just, I just don't understand, Joni. You see your dad drink, you see what happens, and yet you drink. And I looked at her and I said, yeah, Mom, for dad to have the consequences that he has by drinking, it must be good for him to still do that. And she looked at me like I had 2 heads, you know, because she's like, she just didn't get it, and she won't, because she's not alcoholic. An alcoholic goes, mm-hmm, you know, we understand. And I was going to Iowa State, and I was on the dean's list, because, you know, I always have to do more to be maybe equal to. I was working at the bookstore. I was working in the financial aid office on campus, and I was a prostitute at night. I was a very, very busy girl. And it's so funny because, you know, a lot of women came up and, oh, yeah, I was like that, too. I just wasn't smart enough to charge for it. Like, I know. I had to supplement my income, and like I said, apparently I was destined for a career in sales for a long, long time. So that's what I was doing. And when you live like that, you get tired. And I wasn't raised that way, you know? I was raised with a great set of morals. And, you know, you go out and you say, okay, I did that, but I'll never do this. And you set the bar a little lower. And then you go out and do it. Then you say, well, all right, but I'll never do this, and set the bar a little lower. And then you do it. And I guess what was happening is my falling standards couldn't keep up with my actions. They were falling too fast. And each time I did something I said I wouldn't do, I gave away a little piece of my soul, bit by bit by bit. And I came to the point where I had nothing left. And my last night of drinking, it wasn't different than any other, you know. I drank before I got ready to go out to the bar, and I went out and drank. And found the after-hours party, because there's always an after-hours party somewhere with someone. And at some point in time, apparently I got home, because I had, another blackout again. And, when I came to that morning, the four horsemen were there. And once again, I was terrified. And once again, I didn't know how this could have happened again. And I did the room scan, because the first thing you do is do the room scan to figure out maybe where you are. I did the room scan, and I had a little kitty cat at the time. His name was Steel. And Steel was a real pretty steel gray. But Steel was named after a bottle of Steel peppermint schnapps. And he was on top of my head doing the kitty march that they do, purring. So I knew I was in my place. So this was good news. I was home. And then I realized I wasn't alone. And I looked over, and there it was. And this is a little inconvenient because I'm at my place, so I just can't slink out. I have to get rid of it. And this time, it was awake. And it was looking at me, and I was looking at it. And I looked into its eyes. And I was it. The terror in that man's eyes and the disgust and the whole picture was there. And he's like, I can't go. And he took off. And I thought, I need a drink. And I went to the kitchen and opened up the fridge. And there was one Bud Light left. And I popped the top on a Bud Light. And I took a drink and I put it down. And I started crying. And I hadn't cried for a long, long time, You get very icy and very cold and very insulated when you take the actions I take to protect yourself. And I knew it wouldn't work anymore. I knew it just wouldn't work. And it's real funny because beer was not my favorite thing. I loved the taste, the smell, and everything else about hard liquor. And I hated beer. And I think it's just so funny. God has such a sense of humor. That a Bud Light was my last drink. And for years, my mom had been saying, Joan, maybe you should try AA. Have you ever thought about giving AA a try? And for some reason, I was at that point in time where I was so tired and I was so desperate. And mom's words came into my head, and it's like coming to an intersection. And I believe that's the grace of God. And it's not that I have been more blessed than anyone else. It's just the opportunity was there, and I think they happen in people's lives. And I was desperate enough and tired enough to take the action. And I picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous. Found out where the meeting was. I didn't want you to know I was new. We never do, but we always know. So I dressed all up. I went to the first meeting and walked in, hi, how are you, da-da-da-da-da. And I was starting to get a little, when you're detoxing and the hair on your arm stands up and the hair on your head is standing up, and you kind of start doing this little heebie-jeebie shake. So they gave me half a cup of coffee. And when I came in, you could still smoke in the meetings. There was a cloud, about head high. We had ashtrays in there and everything. In fact, that was one of my early jobs, cleaning out the ashtrays. But so I changed, smoked, sat with my back to the wall, because that's what the street tells you. Sit with your, don't let anyone get behind you, honey. And I just watched everyone. And everyone was real nice. Hi, how are you? Da, 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 da. And they do the thing there. Well, I went here for their first meeting. And I was like, I'm not standing up for that. And so they said, is anyone visiting? I had lived in Ames, you know, a couple of years. But I stood up and said I was visiting from Decorah, Iowa, and that I'd been to AA before. And I had once when I was 7 years old with my father. But that's how my mind works. Give me a little bit of the truth and I can stretch it the whole way as far as I need it. And it took me about a week or so to finally stand up and, you know, admit I was new. And that's when I got my first resentment in the program. Because a guy, you know, later, because it was a sharing meeting, so we went around the room and shared. And he's like, oh, it's great to see people stand up, you know, and take their white chip, because they give you a desire chip there. They used poker chips, even if, you know, it's later than it's supposed to be. And I thought, oh, did you know how hard that was? Bite me, you know. So I got my first good resentment. And I started watching him, you know. But it was the first time I had ever felt welcome anywhere in a long time. The guys were cute. And I'll have you know that motives don't matter. You know, if you come around meetings to check out the guys, that's fine. Because, you know, eventually something's going to penetrate into that skull. And you're going to hear something. That's what happened to me. And you guys got me. You know, I caught alcoholism about 3 months after going to meetings. But I was checking out the guys, and they said, come back. And, you know, we went out for coffee. And, you know, just the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous began to happen. And, you know, people were sharing about their stories. And then the guy next to me took out his teeth and laid them on the napkin next to me to tea. So I learned quickly, I'm a quick study, who not to sit next to at coffee. You said some things, you know, keep coming back, don't drink no matter what, get a sponsor, no relationships in the first year. Well, I instantly knew that one of those things would be a very, very bad problem. Well, actually a couple. The steps and the traditions were hanging, and I saw the word God a lot. I thought, oh my, they're going to jump me to Jesus. I grew up with a Norwegian Lutheran background. And the deal with that is, and it's funny, my mom went to the same church services that I did. And she heard God is love and wonderful and, you know, he forgives, yada, yada, yada. I heard, think it, do it, you're going to burn, honey. So I figured I was pretty much kind of hosed in that department. So I thought, well, that was kind of scary, but I might, you know, hang and see. And then the relationship thing was a problem. But it only took a couple meetings, and I spotted him. And he spotted me. And we started immediately doing a sick little dance of death that we did for about a year, year and a half. Because I needed someone there to validate me. And then I got a sponsor. And I had Jean for a couple months. Yeah, it was real funny because she's like, okay, well, this is what I want you to do. We're going to go through the steps. Don't drink no matter what. Go to these meetings where I'll see you and no relationships. I said, oh, too bad. I'm already seeing Pete. Huh. She's like, she was just like, okay, well, we'll see how that goes. And we started going through the steps. And, you know, one of the things, especially early in my sobriety, I mean, drinking had been my answer for so, so long. You know, happy, sunny, nice day. Ooh, let's go party. You know, rainy, crappy, blah day. Oh, well, let's have a drink. You know, kind of ambivalent, kind of medium day. Well, let's have a drink. So it's really hard to deprogram that in your head. So what I had to do, I went to noon meetings so I could make it to the night meeting. And when there was a morning meeting, I'd go to the morning meeting. And then I'd go to the noon meeting. And then I'd go to the night meeting. So as you can imagine, I'm not real sympathetic with pigeons when they say, 90 and 90, I can't do that. I said, don't make me assign you what I did. It's not pretty. Because my head said, let's have a drink. And to get that one person there quieted down, because I have a full committee up here. It's a very scary thing. We have wonderful conversations all the time. But there's one guy up there, and he still lives up there. Let's have a drink, honey. And to get through that, I had to do a lot of meetings, you know, and the people were, you know, wonderful. I mean, there was a couple professors that happened to, you know, go to meetings. And you know, I remember picking up the phone and calling Jerry once and saying, like, I'm going to drink. I can't do this. You know, and he came and picked me up, and we drove around a few blocks, and he's like, you can do this. This is what's going on. It's okay. And I was okay. You know, God bless the people who pick up the phone in the middle of the night or get in the cars to drive across town to talk to a newcomer. That saved my life. And the thing with Gene, we were doing the steps, and it was a couple months into it, and I was just like, you know, I'm not going to school anymore. I was having panic attacks, and I was afraid I was going to flunk everything. So I discovered sobriety through golf, and I picked up golfing in the snow. Very strange. And I'm like, gosh, Gene, I can't do this. I'm not going to school. I'm not doing this. I'm just golfing. She's like, oh, that's okay, honey. I understand that. I'm doing that too. And I thought, ruh-roh. That's not a good sign. So I started looking for another sponsor. And at the particular time where I was, there weren't any strong women. I'm very happy to report that that's changed. And there are some very strong women there now. But at the time, there weren't. And there were a lot of men who were 13-stepping their female pigeons. And I didn't want that. Because I thought, hey, you're stupid. You're not charging for it. For love of God, at least charge for it. You know? And the guy who I had my first resentment against in that meeting, Doug, is who I asked to be my sponsor. He was always at the meetings. He had a smile on his face. He believed in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought I could trust him. And I'm very fortunate because I could. And he would meet me in the basement of the church where the meetings were, an hour before the meetings, so no funny business could happen. And he just took me through the steps. And I really, really believe today that men sponsor men and women sponsor women. And I'll get into more of that later, but Doug started taking me through the steps, and I was still doing my little dance of death with what's-his-face over here, and it was getting very sick because he was still using, but I was going to save him, and he was married but getting a divorce, so that was okay. You know, basically, I've done everything in sobriety that I did drinking, and you know, I was getting very sick, and I remember looking at Doug and saying, how can I don't believe I'm an alcoholic. And he's like, well, Joan, think about this for a little bit. Normal people usually don't come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially 2 to 3 times a day, for 3 months at a time, just to see what we're up to. They're really not interested, honey. And normal people don't sit around and say, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic or not. So go to work and ask a couple of your coworkers. So I march off to work. So Sherry, tell me, are you an alcoholic? And she looked at me like, freak, no, get away from me. But the answer, she was just like, no. I mean, they just know. Normal people, they're like, no. And they give you that look. You know that look. We get that look. We got that look a lot. And it's like, you know, only alcoholics mess around with that. You're toying with it in your head. Shut that guy off, you know? Start doing more service work. Greet at the door for a month. You know, but I hate people. Well, good, greet at the door anyway. But that makes no sense. Just greet at the door. I'm going to prove you wrong. I'll do it. You know, greet at the door. It works. Imagine that. As just, we went through the steps, and we got to the fourth step. And I decided, oh, my, I really, really, really don't want to put this down on paper and look at it, because, you know, when you write it down and put it on a piece of paper, it becomes real. And I knew that wouldn't be good. And then I was really looking at the fifth step about the sharing part, because I really didn't want to share. And you know what he told me was, You are sitting on a fence, a white picket fence, let's say. And what's going to happen, you're either going to do your fourth step or get shoved forward into recovery, or your past is going to come up behind you, grab you by the collar, and drag you back down. Your choice. So I was pondering that for a while, and it was summertime, and I was working for a grassroots organization that you go around and solicit funds in neighborhoods you don't know and towns you don't know. And we left Des Moines, because that's where we were headquartered, and we drove to Hampton, Iowa. That's a good hour and a half from Ames, north of there. And they put us in these, we're in crews, like crews of five or six, and the driver. And it's those old 1970s station wagons with the fake wood, you know, down the side, and, you know, the fumes coming in the back. And we're riding along, and I hear the sound of a pop-top can popping. And, you know how we are. Instantly, I'm like, what's that smell? You know, and I turn around and looked at the guys, and they're like, hey, you want one? And it's Purple Passion Everclear in the can. Now, I made my own jungle juice and was very fond of that because that got me where I wanted to go very, very quickly. And I'm like, dang, I started making that after I got sober. And I'm like, yeah, I do. And my hand went out. And I'm like, wait, no, not right now. Let me think about it. I don't know tonight. They're like, okay, freak, you know, you get that look again. But I was at that point that the big book talks about where at some point in time, and we got to Hampton. And what they did is they dropped you off on street corners of residential areas, and you just, you know, work the neighborhood till they came and picked you up at a certain time. And I knew that evening if I worked the route and someone offered me a beer or a joint, or you get offered lots of things doing these things because I'm a talker, talk to people, and they're, oh, yeah, I want a beer or whatever. I knew I'd take it. So I just started walking, and I came to a phone booth, and I called my roommate. And I'm like, Tiffany, I'm here in Hampton, Iowa, and I just about took a drink, and I want to drink really, really bad. You know, what do I do? And she's like, oh, honey, I'd love to come pick you up, but she had the newcomer car, too, you know, go two blocks, break down. I mean, there's no way she's going to make it an hour and a half. So she's just like, you know, why don't you just walk around, you know, don't work tonight. Would you do your fourth step? You know, that's what's going on here. But just relax and don't drink. It'll be okay. Just make it back. I'm like, okay. So I started walking around this residential neighborhood, and I'm coming up on a side street, and there's a little brick church with big trees and stuff. I'm coming up from the back side. And the thought came into my head that they say, well, when you're desperate, you're supposed to get down on your knees and pray. So I thought, well, I'll go in this church and do that. And I came up, and I walked around the corner, and I looked up at the sign, and it wasn't a church anymore. The sign said, A Recovery House, meetings Mondays and Wednesday nights at 6:30. And it was a Wednesday night, and it was 6 o'clock. I just had to make it a half an hour. And I was desperate. And that was an intersection. And I believe coincidences are God's grace. And I ran back to the phone book, and I called her and said, you won't believe this, because now I'm jazzed. She's like, good, go to the meeting, you know. So I went into the meeting, and I told them what was going on. And they're like, you can do it. Stay sober tonight. Go back. You know, do your four step. And that's what I did. And I wrote all that vile stuff down. And, you know, arranged to do the fifth step with Doug. And we sat down and did my fifth step. And, of course, I thought my stuff would be ever so horrendous. And perhaps he would kick me out in disgust. And I found out he was a Vietnam vet and had done very horrendous things, too. And, you know, he just told me it was okay. And that pushed me forward into recovery. And we started working the other steps. And at this time, Dick and Peg, I'd been sober since February, so I'd been sober about a year and 3 months, a couple came and did a seminar. And Jerry and Jill were with them, too. And they blew me away. As the Alcoholics Anonymous they described was fun and passionate and just, I was an on-the-table-trot bar drinker, woo! And that was the kind of Alcoholics Anonymous they described. And it's like a bunch of strong women came in there and just blew me away. And Doug asked Dick to be his sponsor. And Dick said, I will. But I don't sponsor guys who sponsor women. Men sponsor men, women sponsor women. And Doug's like, okay, I'll, you know, let the girls I sponsor go. And he did. And of course we always, the other gal, he thought she'd be fine and I would cry. She was crying and I was like, cool! Can I ask Peggy? And he's like, well, yeah. And I called Peggy up. And, she remembered me. Imagine that. Because I was very, very sick, and I still looked very, very sick. And she's like, well, honey, I've got my new one for the year, and my sponsor only lets me take on one newcomer with under a year's sobriety, because otherwise I can't give you the kind of attention you need. But I have a pigeon who's just complaining to me about not having enough pigeons. I'll hook you up with Debbie. I'm like, okay. So Debbie called. This was on a Sunday, and I'm like, well, let's give this thing a try. And on Monday, I went over to his place because I'm still doing this sick little dance of death with him, which is really funny because, you know, he was cheating on me, too, and I knew it, and it was a gal that I went to meetings with. And I was so sick that I wasn't mad at him. I was mad at her, okay? Because that's how you are when you're sick and you need a man to validate you. And I had a bad, bad resentment. I mean, the kind of resentment that if she stepped in front of me in the parking lot, I have a stick, I still do, I love five speeds. I wanted to run her over, slam it in reverse, run back over, and go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, just to make sure she was dead. That kind of resentment. And it was killing me, you know? And one of the guys at the meeting, I came in, and she, I was just like, God, I could just kill her. And he knew I was serious, you know. I had murder in my eyes. And he's like, you know what, Joan? I really don't care about her, whatever, but I do care about you. And resentment is the poison you're drinking in the hopes of killing her. And it's going to kill you, and you're going to drink, and I don't want to see that. So you go up to her, and you say, hi, glad you're here. And I said, you go to H-E-L-L. And he said, no, I mean it. Go up, say, hi, glad you're here. You don't have to be her best friend. Just say, you know, do that every time you see her. And I looked at him. There's so many things I've done in my sobriety just to prove someone wrong because it won't work for me, you know. And it does. And I walked up to her, looked at her, said, hi, glad you're here. Turned around and walked away. And she kind of looked a little freaked out, like, you know, she's going to punch me. And every time I saw her, hi, glad you're here. Hi, glad you're here. Hi, glad you're here. And it got easier to do. And then one night, you know, I just grabbed her hand and shook her hand. Hi, glad you're here. You know, how's it going? And then one night, I hugged her. I don't know where that came from, but just, and she looked startled too. I was like, oh my God. But, it was like it was okay. And, what happened, it just went away. And I can't tell you the date and I can't tell you the time, but by doing that action, that awful, gut-wrenching, acid-churning resentment went away. And it was just like, I'm like, oh, she's just an alcoholic too. She got sucked into the crap. You know, no big deal. I am glad she's here. And it was real funny because about 6 months after that, we were at coffee at Perkins. And she came up to the table. I was sitting out with a bunch of people. Said, can I talk to you for a minute? I'm like, sure. Went over to a booth and she looked at me and said, you remember how you hated me? I'm like, don't try me. Yes, I do. You know, don't bring that back up because, oh, yes, if I think about it long enough, yeah, I can go there. And she said, you know, I can tell that you don't hate me anymore. And I said, yeah, that's true, too. She said, can you tell me what you did to get rid of that? Because I hate someone like you hated me, and it's killing me. And I got to tell her. And I get to watch her do it. I love it when things come full circle. And, you know, that was a gift. And I got Debbie on a Sunday. On a Monday, Pete knocked me around a little bit. We were at his apartment, and, you know, no one came when they heard me yell for help. And I got home, and after I finally escaped and called Debbie, "Debbie, this is Joan. He beat me up." She's like, "Oh, relax, take a hot bath, go to a meeting, it'll be okay." And it was real funny because I went to a meeting and there happened to be an Al-Anon meeting at the same church and his ex-wife was there. And she looked at me. She's like, "What happened?" I said, "Well, you know, Pete beat me up." She's like, "Is this the first time?" I'm like, "Well, yeah." She said, "Oh, I thought that had been going on all along. That went on forever with me." I looked at her and said, "Are you nuts? No one hits me, honey." And I told them to stay away from me. So Tuesday night was bowling night. And this is kind of warped and twisted anyway, because I bowled with my ex-mother-in-law, because she still really liked me. I've always gotten along really well with the ex-in-laws. And he came down there. And he made a serious tactical error, because he hit me in front of everybody. And the team we were bowling was the Ames, Iowa Police Dispatchers, ladies. A more rabid bunch of women I have never met. They sprung from their chairs. "Do you want to press charges?" "Yes!" You know. So they hauled him away. I bowled 5 strikes in a row. Everyone's clapping. As we always do, really, really good under pressure, you know. And they hauled him away, and I called Debbie. "Debbie, this is Joan." Tell her the story. She's like, "Relax, take a hot bath. It'll be okay. Go to a meeting." And then it was Wednesday, and Wednesday he used to have no contact with me. And he's a bad, bad alcoholic. And he walks across the street from the police station to the payphone right directly across the street and calls me. So, and I call the DA again, put out another warrant for him, call Debbie, "Debbie, this is Joan," tell her the sad tale. She's like, "Relax, take a hot bath." She's like, "You know, you're going to be a prune before I ever meet you. Is it possible for you to drive to Omaha Friday? I'd love to spend the weekend with you, take you to some meetings," because she's like, "My God, what does this woman look like?" You know, she's just very intrigued by now. I'm like, "Okay." So I did that. And what happened is I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous where I go. The excitement, the enthusiasm, the laughter, it was great. And I drove from Ames to Omaha every weekend and spent spring break there while my ex-mother-in-law watched my 2 cats now, because I'd steal the drunk cat and Bob. Imagine that, as Bob or Bill. He looked like a Bob. She sat my kitties for me while I did that. And I graduated in May and had a party, cake and coffee, with 2 other sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I moved to Omaha. And I moved for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. That's all I had. I didn't have a job. I had found a place to live. It was a get 1 month rent free deal. So I had April free, so I start moving my stuff. And that Monday, I called a temp agency and started working. And 2 weeks later, I was placed at a job where I stayed for 3 years. If it's God's will and you do the footwork, it'll happen. And now we'll get into the part about why men sponsor men and women sponsor women. As I was sponsoring girls in Ames, I was sponsored. I was doing a lot of service work. They started a round up there called Aim for Ames, and I was too much of a glue head and way too new to have anything real responsible. So they let me make the programs, because I was in journalism. So they're like, "Okay, she can do a little artsy thing there." So they just let me do the programs for the first roundup. And I was doing all this stuff and speaking at treatment centers, and it wasn't enough. And I didn't know what was wrong. And what was wrong was Doug couldn't call me on the cutesy little games that women play. And I needed a woman to get a hold of me and do that. And that's what happened. The first thing we had to do was look at my finances. Because I was still writing hot checks and still using credit cards and not paying the bills. And all of a sudden, imagine this, I was afraid to answer my phone because I knew it was them. And I really owed them. And I was afraid they had tracked me down. So she's like, okay, there's a couple things we're going to do. First of all, we're going to burn your checkbook and cut up your credit cards because you can't handle it. You're going to be in the money order world for a while. I'm like, oh, no. So she made me cut up all my credit cards and we had to burn all my checks. You know, I'm so dramatic. It's just wrong. Got a huge coffee can, dumped the checks in, half a bottle of lighter fluid, you know, big flames. Clean start. Going to burn it all up. She said, now you're going to pick up the phone and call everyone you owe and tell them where you are, where you can be found, and what amount of money you're going to mail them on the 15th or the 30th of the month. And I'm like, oh, no, I can't do that. And she's like, yes, you can, and you will. And I don't know why. Again, probably, I'm like, this won't work for me. Fine, whatever. And this was a very good exercise for me because I'm a very arrogant alcoholic, and I have a really big ego. And it's very ego-deflating to call these people, tell them where you are. Yes, in fact, I know I owe you this total, but I'll be mailing you $10, $30, $15 on the 15th or the 30th of the month, whenever it is, in money order form, and then doing it. Because what happens, since you don't bank at a bank anymore, you got a quick shop, quick trip to pick these little money orders up, and when you walk in every payday and get 8 to 10 money orders at a time, the clerks begin to know you. And you walk in and they say, oh, God, it's the money order chick. I did it last time. You do it. That is very ego deflating at depth. And it's also a good exercise because I'm the kind of alcoholic that wants to say, owe you $400? Here you go. Done. Instead of 10, 10, 10, 10, you know, over and over and over. But it's a very good exercise for me. The other thing she said, you know, and a lot of the things that helped me the most, I looked for them between the two covers of the big book. They're not there, you know. And that's why sponsorship is so important to me, because she just went off her experience, just like all my sponsors have. And they've never told me to do anything that would hurt me. And if they haven't had the answer, they've asked me if it's okay to ask their sponsor. So we didn't break the trust. And nowhere in the big book is there a chapter called More About Makeup. There should be for some of us. Because what happened, I was still dressing like I was selling it. I still had a face on like I was selling it. As what happens in the 80s, okay, my hair was big, Aquanet big. It was white, 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 white blonde, i.e. overprocessed. And it looked like a dandelion when it's all big and white right before you go and it falls out. That's pretty much what my hair looked like. And in fact, it was snapping off and wafting in the breeze like dandelions do. Makeup was either bright, shiny pink or bright, shiny powder blue. And see, I caked it on right under my eyebrows. And what happens when you do that is no one can look you in the eye. They can't help it. They're drawn to these beacons here, you know. So she took away my makeup for 1 month. 30 days. I was pissed. I counted down 30 days in my day runner and wrote on the 30th day, can wear makeup again. And she told me I could wear mascara and a little light colored lipstick and that was it. And I was horrified. And I was mad.
And I told her I would do it just to prove her wrong because this wouldn't work. And what happened after she stripped away those layers, people began to look me in the eye and I began to look them in the eye. And it was real funny because after that time frame passed, I wasn't hiding behind my war paint anymore. And she taught me how to apply makeup like a lady. And she taught me how to dress like a lady. And the next evil assignment was the ladies' meeting. The Thursday night ladies' meeting is a regular meeting that I attend. It was mandatory. Everyone went. I hated it. The only thing good about it at that time, and actually this is my favorite thing today, is you can wear sweats or shorts or whatever. You don't have to dress up. I love it. But I hated women. I'm like, no, you don't seem to understand. I hate women. She's like, good, greet at the door for a month. I'm like, no, you don't seem to understand. I hate women. I know, good, greet at the door. And she said, and then there's this pink list. And there was a pink list, front and back, women's names and phone numbers. I feel so bad for newcomers now because it's the pink book. There was like 200, 250 names in there. Ugh, I'm so glad I'm not new. I never want to go back. She said, you will call three women a day out of that book. They will be three different women every day. And that's it until I tell you to stop. And I'm like, oh, man. So I would dial the phone. Hi, this is Joan from the ladies' meeting. My sponsor's making me call you. And they would invariably say, oh, boy, that sucks. My sponsor made me do that, too. I just hated that. And we'd start talking. And the funny thing was, within a month of moving to Bellevue, to Omaha, I knew everyone in the room. And one little gal had been going for quite a while, came up and said, I'm so jealous of you. And I'm like, why? She said, you know everyone. And I'm like, well, yeah, because Debbie intuitively knew that I would take care of knowing the men, which I did. And I said, well, this is what she makes me do. And I do. What happened for me is I fit in. I fit in right away. I felt a part of. People knew my name, and I started getting involved, cleaning up, setting up, and that type of thing. And she said, you can't date. You need a man there to validate yourself, and you're not going to date anyone until you're enough. And you will fill your time doing activities with women. And I'm like, oh, for the love. All right. So I did. Go to movies, go to softball games, go to the beach, hang out, whatever. So I was hanging with the women, and I was having a lot of fun. And I don't know when it happened, but one day I could look in the mirror. And I could look in my eyes in the mirror, and I was enough. And it makes no sense how that happens to me, but it does. And there's not a chapter in the big book called To the Sluts. There really should be. As I knew ground zero about dating. And I spotted him. He was doing security duty at Pockets Roundup. I've always been a sucker for a uniform. That's why I never was thrown in jail. But he had an Air Force uniform on, and he was doing guard duty. And he's like 6'5". That's the goofiest thing. It looked totally ridiculous, but... And I just looked at my girlfriend, Lynn, and I said, who's that? And she said, that's Jeff. Who's the sponsor? Jerry. How long's he been sober? Well, it's 2 months to the day, less than me. I went, perfect. I looked at her, and I said, I'm going to marry him. And she looked back at me and said, Lord, help him. I'm sure you are. And it wasn't... 10 minutes later, I mean, I was sitting at a table having coffee with my friends that came up from the Rhino from Ames, and Jill goes shooting by, because Lynn was sponsored by Mary, and Mary was sponsored by Jill, and Jill's Jerry's wife. So we had done the chain in about 10.3 seconds, and Jill goes scooting by my table. And then Jeff is loping along behind going, who is it? Who is it? Who likes me? Who likes me? And I'm like, oh my God. So I told Debbie I was anticipating being asked out. And she's like, okay, if he does, that's fine. But I'm going to explain to you what a date, honey, is, because you have no idea. You know, a date is not going to his place, getting to know him in the biblical way, and then calling it an evening, okay? This is a real date. He comes to your house, he picks you up. You get in the truck, you go somewhere, a public place, movie, softball, AA function, concert, whatever, I don't care, just make it public, honey. You have a good time, perhaps you go for coffee, perhaps you don't, dinner, whatever. He drives you home. She's like, now this is very important. Pay attention, because this is, I know where I could potentially lose you. He pulls up to your apartment in his truck. He stays in the truck. You perhaps shake his hand, perhaps kiss him on the cheek. No lips, no tongues. This is the first date. You don't even know if you like the man. Say thank you. You get out of the truck. He stays in the truck. You walk into your apartment. You close the door. He is still in his truck. You stay in your apartment. You don't think of any stupid excuse to come running out. He drives away. And you've had your first date. And what happened is we dated like that for like a month and a half, and he freaked out. And he didn't ask me out again for, oh, 2-3 months. It was a long time. And I didn't know why. And it was just, he's like, oh, she's the one. I'm scared. But run. And what happened for me is, because no one gets custody of meetings, I could walk into the meeting, and we were on the same bowling team together, and I told my sponsor, screw him. I'm not quitting my bowling team. He can quit if he's uncomfortable. Because I hadn't done anything to compromise my integrity, I could look him in the eye with my head up, say hi, and not be ashamed of another nasty, dirty thing that I did because I had acted like a real woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wouldn't have had that if she hadn't told me that. And he got unafraid, and we got married. In the meantime, stuff was going on with Debbie, so I got Jill for my sponsor. And we hung and had a great time. I mean, you know, life just took off. And if anyone tells you when you get sober that life is going to be wonderful and it's all happy and it's a bed of roses, run from them. Because I wouldn't trade this deal for anything else in the world, but life still happens. The difference is you learn how to deal with it without being medicated, and you deal with it. And, you know, things are wonderful. So, oh boy, she is like looking at my children. I can look at the genetic pool. Kids are shaking for them and work. You take, I need outside help. We're at the, it was very dignified. Again, no one gets custody of the meetings. And, the children are our primary purpose. And there are no games. And the kids aren't in the middle. And when they go back to Baltimore with Daddy, you know, I don't do the, oh, I'll miss you so much, but I'm like, you go, you have a great time. You're going to see your cousins, you're going to see your grandma, you know. And he does the same thing when they're with me. And we have a great working relationship. He happens to work third shift, so he doesn't have, like, X amount of weekends off. It's forever bouncing. So I'm like, when you have the time off and want the kids, you have the kids. So like this week it was Tuesday, Wednesday night. Next week it'll be like Thursday and Friday. It just bounces around. But the children are our primary purpose. And you've given us that. Because of and by myself, I'd be very vindictive and very vengeful. That's just me, you know. That's one of the voices in my head. Take them out, you know. And it's not that way. And you know, we've been told we've had one of the most graceful, dignified divorces around, so, woohoo! But it's nice, you know, because people are always watching. It's nice to be able to be an example when you can. And, you know, death has happened. This last year, I lost a couple of sister pigeons, you know. Because when Jerry and Jill moved to Florida to start their business and that, I was in a scary, scary spot. I was pregnant with my daughter, and it's getting new boss, and things weren't, with Jeff, weren't our good. So I'm like, God, honey, I love you so much. I've been with you 7 years, but I'm a real alcoholic, like the big book says, and I need someone watching me, which it turned out is true. So I got Peg, and, you know, Joan Wilson died, and Lee died, and they were young, and, you know, cancer, and boom, gone. And that brings home the point that life is short, and all we've got is right here, right now. You know, hang on for the ride. It's great. And enjoy, because I believe in laughter and I believe in having fun. When you're given a laugh like I've got, it sounds like a bunch of geese are landing on the pond for winter, for God's sake. You have to laugh, you know. But I honk when I laugh. But that's very convenient, because I never get left anywhere. They just track me down by my laugh. That worked drinking and it worked sober, so that's good. I have these three little doggies. I have little Pembroke Welsh Corgi doggies, and for fun, I herd sheep. It's relaxing. It's fun. I make a fool out of myself. They enjoy it. It's what they're bred for, you know. Let's call it a hobby, because I decided one of the important things to do was also expand my horizons and get another circle of friends, so I do the dog thing. And I became very, very close with Ellen, who's a breeder of them. I just love her to death. And she passed away last June. And I was real angry. I was real angry because it was pancreatitis, and the hospital and the doctor missed it for 6 weeks. And it killed her. And I had to be reminded once again of the law of man, the law of nature, and the law of God. And for me, the law of man is a doctor making a mistake and missing something. Someone crossing the center line in a car and causing an accident. Man-made mistakes. Then there's the law of nature. And the law of nature is tornadoes and floods and hurricanes and, you know, a tornado doesn't hit someone's house because they're less blessed than I am. That's crap. It's just nature. It's a wind pattern. And then there's the law of God. And I believe God is love. And I believe that God has received the people that I love. He didn't take them away. You know, He's received them into a much better place. And I believe that, and that comforts me. And, you know, it was funny because she passed away on a Thursday, and a gal from Kearney, who's an AA, who was hungry for the Fellowship of Women, asked if she could come stay with me. And I'm like, sure, because she knew, mutual friend. And Allie came, and we were sitting out on my deck, chain smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee like we do at 10:30 at night. And I was telling her about Ellen and how much I loved her and how much I missed her. And if Allie hadn't been there, I wouldn't have seen this. But right after I finished telling her that, the biggest shooting star I have ever seen in my entire life shot across the sky. And I knew it was Ellen. And when you see a shooting star, you're supposed to make a wish. And I did. And I wished that her husband, Eric, and her son, Jesse, who was 12, who had already lost his first daddy, would find peace. That's not me. That's you. That's Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship and the fellowship. Because of and by myself, I would have wished to win the Powerball, because it's all about me, and that's how I am. And, you know, I've received many, many blessings here. You know, I sponsor, and they're just a trip, and they keep me on my toes. And they ask me questions that I ask my sponsors, because, you know, you get what you are. Why do I have to do this? I don't think it'll work. Why do I have to do this? And finally, I've had to, okay, have you ever bought a cake mix? Uh-huh. You open it up, you look inside, and there's this grayish, kind of brownish, weird, powdery-looking crap. It's not what's shown on the front of the box. It's not cake. You flip to the back of the box, and there's a set of instructions. You know, you need water, you need eggs, you need to preheat your oven, you need to mix it up. Have you ever said, why do I have to set the oven at 350? Have you ever cranked it up to 500 because you're impatient and hungry and want to get there? Or have you set it on 350? Have you ever asked, why a cup of water? Why not half a cup of water? Why not 3/4 cup of water? Have you ever said, why 2 eggs? Why not 3? Why not a dozen? Have you ever done it and put them in anyway just to see what happened? No. You followed the instructions, and you've gotten cake. You do the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, guided by a sponsor. You get what we have. And it's a gift. And this is more than I ever could have imagined. And I'm very blessed. And all I can do to keep it is give it away. And I do the best I can on a daily basis with that. Thank you so much for having me here. It's very, very lovely. And I'm looking forward to a great weekend with you. Thank you.